Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today, in post-Easter mode, we are looking at Christianity, specifically some of the things which are keeping Christianity, in my opinion, going, which is apparitions of the Virgin Mary. But before, there I was on Easter Sunday looking at the Urbi et Orbis papal address, which is his customary self, and apart from being quite bedeviled by the fact that the Pope is getting quite frail and old, even though he has become the oldest Pope in office, what surprised me was the numerous references to Mary Magdalene which he made, and the way he brought it about was basically that, you know, he singled out Mary Magdalene as the first person who saw the risen Jesus. And then he basically kept on talking about Mary Magdalene quite often for no reason. And I felt it was interesting that the church and whoever wrote this speech begins to focus on Mary Magdalene without really having to do so. I remember that this Pope, less than 10 years ago, was speaking out against the Da Vinci Code, basically saying that it was not necessarily a work of evil, but definitely something which he discouraged his people to read. And you know, all of a sudden we are being shown what I think was actually a very interesting and very correct interpretation of the role of Mary Magdalene. She was identified as the first to have seen Jesus risen ahead of all the apostles, and later on he actually included her as amongst the apostles and again singled her out on a number of occasions. So I thought that was definitely of interest. And you had some observations about why the Pope might be doing this at this moment in time, Kathleen.
Well, you know, I mean, look, this Pope is not any great friend of the Divine Feminine, so I don't have any illusions that he, you know, is celebrating Mary Magdalene in any way, because he feels this in his heart and his spirit, that the Church is having any great change of heart. So, you know, I want to emphasize that. While at the same time, I do want to say that progress is progress, and I will take it. But I think in a lot of ways the Church has been forced to acknowledge Mary Magdalene in ways that they never have before. I mean, the Magdalene movement is growing exponentially all around us. I mean, it's, you know, the Da Vinci Code certainly, you know, caused the first major earthquake. And the rest of us who have been writing about Magdalene long before, still, and will be writing about her long since, have certainly contributed to this in some way. And more people are celebrating this idea of Mary Magdalene as the apostle of the apostles and her importance in this story. You know, it's becoming a very strong popular phenomenon. And it's actually, you know, in some ways, it's almost like what happened in the 12th century in Europe. The Magdalene movement started to have such a strong following. More and more people were being called to these various heresies, specifically Catharism. You know, we go back and we look at what's happening with the Cathars and the, you know, in the 12th and 13th century. We look at how the Church massacred the Cathar people during the Crusades on the feast day of Mary Magdalene to make their point that worship of her would not be tolerated. You know, so what we had was this growing Magdalene movement, this resurgence of passion for who she was, for the fact that, you know, that she is revered in France and other parts of Europe as, you know, the real founder of Christianity there, that she is the one who comes there and founds the first missions and first churches and has been completely forgotten about. But she hadn't really, and there were those who were paying tribute to her, and this movement toward who she was and the pure spirituality that she brought with her that was completely uncontaminated by dogma, by politics, by economics, and that was strictly about the spirit of faith and love and community that she was teaching. So this resurgence of Magdalene mania starts to really burst forth, you know, by the end of the 12th century, it's in full bloom, and the church panics, and ultimately the crusade against the Cathars is launched. Well, I think that the time returns. I think that this is happening all over again. You know, when Guillaume Bellebast said at his execution in 1321 that in 700 years, the laurel will turn green again, you know, he was saying that 700 years from my death, we'll come back and this will happen again. And these teachings will have a resurgence. And that is exactly what's happening. And that is what's happening now. But gone are the days when the Pope can declare a crusade against the people who believe in this kind of power, who believe in this sort of Gnostic, beautiful, faith-driven version of Christianity that Mary Magdalene represents. Because this isn't just about Mary Magdalene. This is about what she represents, not just as Jesus's wife, not just as the mother of his children, but most specifically as the leader of his movement once he passed. So this Magdalene movement is resurging again, just like it did 700 years ago, only now the Pope can't declare a crusade and wipe all of us out. I think he probably wishes that he could, but he can't. So the church has to come up with another strategy. And I think their strategy is, if you can't beat them, join them. They have to now acknowledge that Mary Magdalene is important. They have to now acknowledge that there are many, many people out there who are looking at her importance and who have accused the church of trying to cover up her importance. So now if they acknowledge her, if they step into this idea and say, look, we are mentioning her in our Easter sermons multiple times. We are talking about her importance. I think that that becomes sort of their means of becoming a part of this Magdalene movement, of stepping into it. And I think of hopefully not losing more people, more of their faithful, to this modern, more Gnostic movement towards celebrating the Magdalene.
Well, absolutely. And I think that is, you know, a very specific driver for them. They realize that people are dropping off and that they need to somehow make sure that they stay in there. And it's probably somebody who within the church at one point said, you know, like, well, actually, Mary Magdalene is a Catholic saint. Why don't we just, you know, get her closer to us than we have been using and use her for making sure that these people stay with us. And I think, you know, what is happening there is something which was happening more than a century ago, something 100 to 150 years ago, and specifically in France. And this is really the entire story of the Marian apparitions. And there is this, it's not this joke, and it's actually a statement which is out there, and I think it actually perfectly quite underlines the truth of the situation, which is that Marian apparitions these days are actually keeping the church popular. And definitely when you look at places like Lourdes, when you look at various other places, you do see this huge devotion to apparitions, to the messages which the Virgin Mary is set to give to mankind. And I've been studying this, as have you, for a number of years, and it is definitely my take that the church had to embrace these things. For a long period of time, they didn't really know what to do with it. Then they felt that it wasn't really anything to do with Christianity as such, but then they realized that they could put their teeth in it and make it, transform it into something which would suit them. And that is really something which they have been doing ever since. And again, when you look to places like Fatima today or Lourdes today, you really see that these are part of a very well-oiled, slick Vatican business as usual, which really brings in the crowds by the thousands, and you know, which actually makes these people come there because they feel that this is where the real power is. I quite often think that the Marian apparitions and the shrines linked with these apparitions are more powerful for the everyday Christian today who practices his or her faith than the power points of the faith itself, you know, the objects linked with Jesus. Things like the shroud, things like you know, the places in Jerusalem, some of the relics in Rome. those are visited, but when you compare the few people who do the Santa Scala in Rome to the thousands of people who each day drop off in Lourdes, it's clear that the Virgin Mary somehow seems to be far more popular than Jesus is to Catholics today. And that is definitely a very weird thing to kind of like conclude, I think, from the current state of Christianity.
Well, you know, I don't know that I would say that she is more popular, but she certainly has, you know, her share. And I think that's because for a lot of Catholics, and particularly European Catholics, the Virgin Mary is very accessible. You know, she is someone who they can connect with in an interesting way. I want to back up just for a second and say that if you did not see the Newsweek from the last week, the cover article of Newsweek magazine in the States has a very interesting picture of Jesus. And it says, "Forget the church, follow Jesus." And it's an article by Andrew Sullivan. Andrew Sullivan is not someone that I normally have a lot of agreement with in his work. And there are elements of this article that got under my skin a little bit. But the gist of the article, the idea of the article, is really important. And what he's saying in the article is, what's happening now in the 21st century is more and more people are becoming disillusioned with organized religion. People are defecting from traditional churches at an extraordinary rate, but they are finding Jesus in their own way. And, you know, he doesn't actually say this is a Gnostic movement, but he is referring to the fact that there is an option. You can follow Jesus in your own way. You can follow his word. You can understand what he was teaching without being caught up in the politics and the dogma. The economics, all these things that modern churches are completely immersed in. And so I think that was an important article for Easter in the 21st century in 2012. And I think that really matters. But going back to what's happening in Europe, what has happened with the Marian apparitions, you know, one of the things that you and I have talked about here and elsewhere before is what becomes very interesting about these apparitions, people seeing a divine lady who comes to them, is that they are most often seen by children. A lot of the descriptions that we have, the information that we have, come from children. And there is sort of a beauty and an innocence to what they see. But on the other hand, so many of these apparitions have been interpreted for us by the church. And in so many cases where these apparitions have happened, we actually no longer even have access to what the children originally saw. We only have the church's version of what the children saw. And that is something that to this day I find distressing.
Absolutely. And it is actually the subject of an article which I have in the current issue of Nexus New Times magazine. It is available in America. It is actually being imported by the thousands from the UK edition. And so it is limited available in America. The American edition is still not up and running again, but hopefully will be within the next year or so. But, you know, go online, you can get it on my webpage, and we will put a link up. And basically, when I started doing research into the Marian apparitions, I didn't realize how, you know, how powerful this movement was and how controversial this movement was, and also how un-Catholic this was. We have this notion that somehow this happens to young girls who are absolutely Catholic and then overindulge in themselves with, you know, Jesus and admiration, that some are said to either become, you know, so identified with him that they're beginning to see the signs of the crucifixion or are beginning to have visions of the Virgin Mary. And fact of the matter is, that is simply not the case. Lucia Santos, the principal witness of the apparition at Fatima, wasn't even brought up as a Catholic. Her father was an atheist, and there's a very interesting episode whereby the series of apparitions in 1917, which began on the 13th of May and ended on the 13th of October of that year, 1917, when afterwards he was asked by people, well, you know, you don't believe in Jesus, so kind of like, you know, what is this? What your daughter has witnessed? What really is this? And he said, like, well, I don't know, but the only thing I can come up with right now is that probably I was wrong. And there are other instances of children. Quite often it's 50-50 divided between girls and boys. And and quite often the boys kind of, you know, went off to live lives. And quite often they were all given, you know, the secrets of Fatima stand out there. But there were quite a number of instances whereby other people were given messages by this apparition as well. And, you know, to put it in perspective, there is nowhere any mention firsthand that this is the Virgin Mary. Even Lucia Santos's documents, the ones which the church reluctantly put open a few years ago in Portugal, when asked did she ever identify herself as the Virgin Mary, Lucia basically says, no, she did not. Other instances where this apparition has occurred, it always makes it clear that it is a Lady of Light, a lady, but never is it identified as the Virgin Mary. It is the Church who says, oh, well, this is the Virgin Mary. And each case of an apparition becomes more and more evidence for the Church because they can refer to previous apparitions. But there is, and we're obviously going to explore this in further detail, but there is so much there that really makes it apparent that what is going on here is something far more complex than just the Virgin Mary appearing. For example, in Lourdes, which is, you know, a very interesting place, and the reason why the Church likes Lourdes so much is because Lourdes sat within a series of apparitions whereby the apparition was giving an awful lot of negative feedback to the Church. Just before in La Salette, the apparition had basically said that the Church was corrupt, that priests were doing things which they shouldn't be doing, which basically meant was that they were not living in the way they should be living. They, you know, they didn't look after their flock. They basically lived quite often a life of luxury and an elitist kind of way, which this apparition felt didn't reflect a positive manner. And La Salette and a few other incidences which were happening in France basically meant that the Church was in a bit of a problem. And then all of a sudden Lourdes happens and Bernadette sees this apparition, and all of a sudden everything is fine again because the apparition in Lourdes is very happy with the Church. And ever since, you know, Bernadette stands out as this symbol of apparitions. But when people are beginning to do research, even in the Lourdes case, what they're actually finding is that these apparitions were occurring before the apparition which turned out to be identified as the Virgin Mary. Other people had come to that cave. People knew that that cave was special. People had witnessed certain things there. And Bernadette was just one out of a long queue of people who had seen something special there. But it was her apparition which became identified as being one of the Virgin Mary, and to some extent seized upon by the Church, because the Church was looking for a positive message after La Salette. And to, you know, a large extent, the Church has ever after Lourdes, after La Salette, realized that they needed to control the game. They needed to control the scene, and specifically, they needed to control the people involved. And, of course, this Pope was before head of the modern equivalent of the Inquisition, and he was singularly responsible for making sure that nobody ever got access to Lucia Santos.
Well, and that becomes a really important issue here. And for those of you out there who are readers of my books, if you read the Book of Love, I speak in great length about what happened to Lucia Santos and about how this poor, beautiful, amazing visionary, who was probably one of the great mystics, not just of our time, but of any time, was from the time she was 11 years old, kept under lock and key by the church, lived to be a very old woman and lived under a vow of silence, basically as a prisoner of the church, where she was not able to tell her version of the story to anybody except those people who were approved by the Vatican to talk to her. And by the end of her life, only Pope John Paul II and Cardinal Ratzinger, who is now the Pope, were allowed to speak with her. So this is the kind of strict control that they have put on these people who have had visions, who are truly visionaries. And, you know, going back to the current Pope, who was the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which was previously referred to as the Inquisition, you know, in 1978, this congregation issued the criteria for evaluating apparitions. Basically, it said there are rules for us to determine whether or not what you have seen is officially a Marian apparition. So once again, we have the very, very strict controls of the church. The church is going to determine whether or not what you see is legitimate. And this is, you know, a subject that I talk about almost every week in one form or another, is this idea of how our mysticism has been taken from us. Our ability to have a Gnostic experience, to have a one-on-one experience with the divine over the last 2,000 years has really been taken from us by the church. And it's something that we are trying to reclaim. And I think that, you know, this is the fear that the church has of things like the labyrinths, you know, eliminating the labyrinths, ripping them out of the Gothic cathedrals. All of that is about not allowing people to have a personal one-on-one divine experience. Well, this same thing happened. These criteria for evaluating apparitions are so strict that it would actually, I think, intimidate anyone who was a Catholic from coming forward to say, I saw something. I think it would be very scary to know that if you're going to come forward and say, I saw something extraordinary, I had an extraordinary vision in this place, to know that you were, you know, subjecting yourself to potentially a lifetime of scrutiny by the church is something that I personally wouldn't want to have, you know. And I was actually looking through this criteria that they published in 1978. You know, the positive criteria, you know, it's all so subjective. They must determine, you know, moral certainty. You know, I'm not really sure how you determine moral certainty, but you have to determine the moral certainty of the apparition and the people who had it. You have to evaluate the personalities and the qualities of the people in question. Are they mentally balanced? Are they honest? Do they lead a moral life? Are they sincere? Are they obedient to church authority? Are they willing to practice the faith in the normal way? Those two things kill me. When I see that obedience to church authority and willingness to practice faith in the, quote, normal way was part of the criteria for evaluating apparitions, that just kind of sends me over the edge. So if I had if I witnessed an apparition, it would never under any circumstances be accepted by the church as being valid, because I don't follow church authority and I don't live my life in the, quote, normal way of practicing Christianity.
And I think to some extent, you know, the church just want to frighten people off by going there and saying they've had Marian apparitions, because it's something which scares them. They have no idea what to do with them. And in the case of Lucia, you know, it was abhorrent what they did. Again, Lucia never wanted to become a nun. She was pushed into this. It was felt that it would be in her best interest, given the exposure she had had, that maybe she should be somewhere else, that it would be better for her. And, you know, basically they do a mind trick on her family, whereby they say, maybe, you know, we can take better care of your daughter than you can. And the family goes along with this, but she doesn't want to. Then they put her in a system whereby she will be forever forbidden to speak, because it was a quiet congregation in which she she partook, and she was sent to a country where she didn't speak the language, nor, of course, in a quiet congregation do you have much opportunity to learn the language. As you pointed out, access to her was extremely strictly regulated. Towards the end of her life, only the Pope and Ratzinger, who pretty much was Pope on a practical daily basis, because after the assassination attempt in 1981, the health of John Paul II quite rapidly declined, specifically in the 1990s onwards. And, you know, they made sure nobody got to speak with her. As you always point out, when she died, they searched her room. But she had constant apparitions. Her apparitions weren't limited to Fatima in the summer of 1917. She had them afterwards, some of them which she went on record with, which were written down, but clearly far more than ever got recorded.
Well, Lucia did have apparitions her entire life, from what we understand. And just to expand on what you said, after she died, they didn't just search her room. They treated the entire convent like a crime scene. After she died, they taped it off. They forbade anyone to go anywhere near the spaces where she had lived until every inch of it had been turned over. There was someone who actually lived and worked in the convent at the time who said they cut open her mattress. They searched inside the walls. They were looking for anything that she might have left that actually had her version of the story on it, or her accounts of any of the visions or apparitions that she had seen. Now, after I believe it was in the 40s, the first book came out about what Lucia said she saw, and it had her name on it as the author. But of course, everything that was published about what she actually saw, what her visions were, what the Virgin Mary said to her, or what the Divine Lady said to her, all came through Vatican publications. You know, certainly there was never anything published about what Lucia Santos saw or heard or knew or understood that did not come through the public relations office of the Roman Catholic Church. And up until including the day she died and beyond, the need to control whatever it was that she was seeing and hearing was so extreme. I mean, I cannot emphasize this enough. This woman was basically in solitary confinement for 70 years. She was not allowed to speak to anyone. She had, for 20 years, she was allowed to have a private confessor, her own priest that she was allowed to talk to. And then they even released him and did not allow her to have that anymore. So, you know, what she went through is to me so tragic. You know, and if you've ever seen pictures of her, there's some beautiful footage of her near the end of her life, actually where she's with the Pope. And there is just this very beautiful light around her. She's such an extraordinary spirit. Even after everything that she had been through, she still had this kind of unbelievable lightness and beauty about her. But I can't even imagine, you know, what she endured for the sake of being honest about having these visions.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the article, I speak a lot about how the church really made a propaganda war out of the visions and the secrets of Fatima. And basically, the story, of course, is that in 1917, they were given secrets. The two other children who were there with Lucia died soon afterwards. And so Lucia became the sole caretaker of these secrets. And she was set to reluctantly write them down and communicate them. And then in 1941, they were published. And two of them, of the three secrets, were published. And basically, it was a revelation that the Virgin had predicted something, which was communism, which wasn't anything new, because she had spoken out against this communism thing before, at least if we are to believe what the church says she said in previous apparitions. And in these scenarios, what happened was that the first and the second one basically spoke about the fact that if communism wasn't stopped, something atrocious was going to happen. And then again, you know, quite often it maddens me when books just say, you know, Lucia said, we have no idea what she said. You know, she never spoke. She was not allowed to speak. Everything which she said came through the church. So if we believe the church, Lucia then said that the third secret had to be revealed before 1960 or when she was going to die, but 1960 at latest, and she lived far longer than 1960. And in at the end of the 1950s, the popes did ask for the written down third message. Some of them consulted it, some of them consulted it afterwards, but nobody made it public. And that really dragged on for an awful long period of time. In the 1990s, there were various wild conspiracy theories, somewhat aided by the internet, as to what this third secret contained. I remember Whitley Strieber once speaking out, saying that his information was that the third secret contained, you know, the revelation that there was extraterrestrial life. Everybody was reading something into this third secret, and the church, I think, began to realize, and this Pope began to realize, that this was beginning to work against them. And so what happened was that in 2000 and 2001, a rapid succession of events meant that the secret was released, and it was announced that the third secret had to do with the papal assassination attempt in 1981. What happened there was that on May 13th, 1981, a person who seems to have had connections with communism, in the sense that he was likely a hired assassin from communist regimes, pulled the trigger trying to kill the Pope, who people say actually quite miraculously was the bullet didn't hit his heart, it just sat nearby. And again, if we are to take the word of the alleged assassin who was trying to get out, he later said that he, as a trained assassin, knows that when he fires, then he knows what is going to happen with that shot, and he was absolutely sure that the shot he had fired was going to kill the Pope, yet miraculously the Pope survived. You know, whether that is true or not, or whether the Vatican once again puts more flowers around this than the truth dictates, is something which will be no doubt a matter of great debate forever. But there is definitely something to be said for the fact that the Pope believed that there was a connection to Fatima. The following year, on May 13th, there was a celebration in which he gave the bullet to the Bishop of Fatima and basically asked that the bullet would be put in the shrine of the Virgin at Fatima, a move which at that moment in time didn't really make much sense. But various events, and some of them are related in that article, and some actually in another article which I have written on the icon of Russia, which basically was in Fatima at that moment in time, and which was used by the same Pope in the war against communism. Basically, he either really felt that you know there was a connection with Fatima and his papal assassination, or he quickly realized that this was the greatest coup he could use in trying to bring communism down. And to a large extent, he did. He was very instrumental in opening up Poland, together with Ronald Reagan, on a very political scheme, supporting financially the troops who were striking in Poland. For large number of months, the Vatican was actually paying the likes of Lech Walesa money so that Solidarity movement, who was striking, actually that those people got paid. Those people got paid through the Vatican, and John Paul II only went to Reagan when, in essence, the Vatican Bank could no longer maintain keeping the Polish economy ticking over. But that's a side issue. Basically, what began from 1981 onwards was this drive for the and by the Pope and by the Vatican to spin the third secret into something having to do with Definitely the papal assassination, and once again communism. Now, something which very few people know is that in 1917, Lucia was interrogated by the local bishop, and this interrogation was sealed and remained shut for almost a century. And then it was opened and it was studied by very few people in Portugal who were allowed special entrance to this. And those people have written a number of books on them, a trilogy. And in my opinion, a bit unfortunately, the books lacked impact because as the trilogy went on, they began to proclaim that what really had been happening there was something of a UFO encounter. And in my opinion, it was detrimental for them underlining that they had access to this material, this raw material, these first interrogations of Lucia. And so, whereas the church since 1941 onwards was proclaiming that these third secrets, or these three secrets of Fatima, were world-shattering and very important for the future of the world, and that the Virgin Mary was proclaiming, you know, that we should all unite against communism, when Lucia is asked by the bishop about whether or not she has been given secrets, she says yes. She says she cannot divulge what they are. And when he says, are these things which affect an awful lot of people? To which she replies, no. And basically the resulting picture is that this is a message which is given to her and the other children involved, and maybe their direct families, but nothing really beyond that. And when the priests or the bishop asks if people of the world were told about the secret, would their life in any way be changed? To which Lucia answers in 1917, no, they wouldn't. So definitely she in 1917, when she was still allowed to talk, clearly felt that these secrets had nothing to do whatsoever with the grandiose schemes which the church would later make them into. And I think once again what we're seeing here is the careful manipulation, the careful propaganda machine of the church, who spins and doctors and makes all of these things fit and work for their own agenda. But at the very heart is something very basic, and that is that there were three children there who had a very interesting, very anomalous experience, which later got completely usurped by the powers of the Vatican to be molded and suited and fitted for their purposes.
Well, let's kind of branch off here for a minute, because, you know, one of the things that you touched on earlier was this idea that In most cases, the children never identify the woman that they see as the Virgin Mary. They say that they've seen a beautiful lady, a lady who is radiant with light, a lady who is clothed with the sun, you know, those kinds of things. This idea of she is the Virgin Mary is something that is put upon the apparition later on. Now, you also touched upon this idea that people sort of ran with some of these phenomenal things that happen in Fatima, like the issue of the dancing sun, which you can talk about, and how they then went on to say, oh, well, this is actually a UFO phenomenon, which, of course, I do not believe. But it's getting a lot of play. Certainly on your show, Ancient Aliens, they have talked about this idea of what these people are seeing as an alien encounter. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about sort of these other ideas of what this could be. I mean, for me, obviously, I have a very different perspective. My perspective is that this is a manifestation, the divine feminine and the female aspect of God, any way you want to look at it or call her. If that becomes a Virgin Mary for somebody, then so be it. That's the clothing in which they put upon this image. It's the known ideal that they can hang this extraordinary experience upon. But I, you know, personally think that it can be something broader than just the Virgin Mary. And, you know, to your point about Lucia Santos not even being Catholic, when she has this apparition, you know, it can be a lot of different things. It doesn't have to be the Virgin Mary. But I was hoping that maybe you would want to expand a little bit on some of the phenomena that happened around Fatima and how people – a lot of people believe that has a UFO attribute, and how you feel about that.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. The lady definitely is, I would say, unidentified. She never was flying, nor was there an object. So to try and push this into the UFO bailiwick is, I think, something of a stretch. Anomalous experiences, to some extent, share some commonality, and that was used by these investigators to basically say, you know, well, there is a different kind of time experience. You know, these witnesses spoke of certain things, and we have also seen this in UFO stories, and that is all true, but that doesn't make it a UFO connection or anything to do with UFOs. Now, what happened in Fatima, I think, more than anything else, is this fact of repetition. Most encounters like this, even if, you know, people before Bernadette saw things in this cave near Lourdes, it was haphazard. There was no regularity for this. Yet what we see in Fatima is clearly something which has an intelligence. Clearly something is happening here. And so what we see is that on May 13th, basically the apparition tells them that the children should return on every 13th afterwards of every month, and that she will appear to them. Now, an interesting thing is that the circus got underway relatively quickly. And the circus was at its maximum in August, when I think it's the local mayor or some person with some power basically didn't necessarily arrest the children, but definitely made sure that they were under his control so that they couldn't go to the side of the apparition. And so what happened was that on the 13th, I think it's of the month of August, nothing happened. The children were not there. And so what happened was that the following day or 2 days later, the children went, obviously never alone, because guess what? As soon as those kids ran into that direction, there were you know, dozens if not hundreds of people who ran with them into that direction. And what happened was that the apparition appeared to them then, and that somehow the apparition knew that you know, something, that they weren't there on August 13th. Now, the apparition in Fatima was not just something which was witnessed by the children. The children were the only ones who saw the lady, but everybody else realized that something bizarre was happening. They noticed strange weather phenomena, they noted strange sounds, they noted strange lights coming from specifically the top of a tree. And of course, all of this peaks in on October 13th, 1917, when the sun was said to have been standing still for a good few minutes. Now, clearly, if this was factual, that means that the Earth stopped rotating. And clearly that is not what happened, but something clearly magical happened. And on October 13th, there were thousands of people there, including several skeptics. There are reports of many skeptics who specifically went there to basically expose this fraud, to show that there was nothing to this. And the skeptics who went there all came away believers, some of them in Catholicism, but definitely in the fact that what happened there was true, that what they witnessed was, again, not physically the sun standing still, but that the light which was emanating from above the tree was, to call it with one thing which doesn't explain it, but which somewhat describes it, supernatural. That the, again, that even though they couldn't see the young child described as about 5 feet tall, about 15 years old, even though they couldn't see it sitting above the tree, they saw clearly a light there. They realized that something was there, something physical, or, you know, something otherworldly which had manifested itself into our realm was definitely there. And again, even the skeptics were absolutely convinced of this. And that is, of course, what sets Fatima apart from so many Marian apparitions. And I would say all paranormal phenomena. The fact that here was an intelligence who made contact with these children. And there's one very interesting thing. And I think this is, like, you know, Fatima was one of these things whereby the world could have been different if only it hadn't gone the way it had gone. And this is this, that a group of psychics in the months leading up to the first apparition on May 13th, specifically in Portugal, they said that there was going to be a very important event happening. And one group of psychics actually said that the most important paranormal event in the history of mankind was going to happen. And they wrote about this. One of these groups actually paid for, not necessarily an advert, but like an announcement in a local newspaper, so that their prediction would be recorded before it actually happening. And then once it happened, these groups of psychics seems to have gone either completely silent, not knowing that the apparitions were happening, or basically were pushed into silence. Their voice was not going to be heard. It was Catholicism which was going to take center stage. But clearly, in a group of psychics, clearly, you know, knew that something very important was going to happen from May 13 onwards in Portugal. And I'm just wondering, you know, if it hadn't been for the spiel which the church had put on this, if only the church hadn't been all-powerful in this sense of being able to oppress and suppress what had been happening, the world would have been a different place. The story of Fatima would have been seen as proof, as evidence of, you know, paranormal things happening, of other intelligences being there, of being able to contact us, of imparting information with us and sharing this. It would have cemented so many other things which, you know, other people had seen. And I think that is really the lost opportunity of Fatima. And I don't think we should try to shoehorn Fatima into the UFO phenomenon. The you know, Fatima and apparitions sit in a category of this of their own, which is the fact that in certain locations somehow otherworldly intelligences are able to manifest themselves and communicate with us. And I think that deserves to be recognized as a whole entire phenomena of its own, rather than trying to push it into UFOs or anything else.
So let's talk for a bit about Medjugorje, because this is the one that I'm really fascinated with, you know, right now. This idea in 1981 in what was then Yugoslavia, which is now Croatia, that there was an apparition of the Virgin Mary witnessed by six children. Now, this has become extremely controversial. The local bishop swears that it's a hoax. The church announced in 2010 that they were going to do a investigation into it. But for 30 years, people have been coming from all over Europe to this place as a place of pilgrimage and firmly believe that there were Marian apparitions seen here. So my question for you is this just another case of the church trying to control it? Why do we think this bishop is so adamantly against acknowledging that there was an apparition here? And what do you think is really going on there?
Well, I mean, and the Medjugorje thing isn't helped by the fact that newspapers and I think a Channel 4, which is a British television channel, documentary, actually found evidence that during the Bosnian conflict there were fake pilgrims going to Medjugorje, and that basically the transports were used to smuggle weapons into Bosnia-Herzegovina to kind of, you know, basically aid with the rebel forces, and that the church once again was caught, and various high profile church charity organizations in the UK were caught as basically being in cooperation with a political war, and these organizations were knowingly involved. It wasn't just that somebody was using them without them knowing it. They were very much aware of it. So that made Medjugorje even more controversial. But I think, you know, whether or not it happened, I think in all of these cases, I think, and in Medjugorje as well, something happened. And then it is up to the church to either embrace that. And sometimes they embrace it for a while, and then they throw it out. And I think that's what happened with Medjugorje. I think what's happening there is that for some reason at this moment in time, it is felt to be inconvenient, and so they try to toss it out. But I do believe that in origin, these six children saw something. Now, I don't know what's going on locally. Are these people somehow beginning to try and get themselves from under the oppression of the church? Are they beginning to say that maybe they didn't see the Virgin Mary, that they saw something else? You know, there are so many possibilities which are happening right there that maybe it'll take a bit longer for the truth to come out. But it's definitely been a long-standing perspective that the church always tried to get their hands on these people. You know, Lucia Santos is by far the most famous case, and to some extent their biggest success story. One of the boys in La Salette ran away from home, was living on the streets, actually near Saint-Sulpice in Paris. And there's a very interesting thing, because he was entrusted with one of the secrets. One night, he was actually courted by locals who took him in, who realized who he was. And they thought that if they fed him and entertained him and, you know, put beautiful girls in front of him, that somehow he was going to speak. And one day he said that he was ready to speak, that he had the words of the secret on the lips of his mouth, and that he was about to reveal all to his audience. And he says, and then another supernatural event happened. He says he couldn't speak. He literally could not utter a single sound. And so by divine intervention, he believed he was actually stopped from uttering these secrets. And maybe that's a lesson which the Vatican should learn, because they definitely treat all of the people who see these things as things to be controlled and owned and dictated to. And I think that's the same thing in Medjugorje as anywhere else. Again, Fatima has had its up and downs. Definitely La Salette is something which the church for a very long period of time tried to not support, even though there is an active movement of pilgrimages to La Salette. The church is very happy that pilgrimage and that site of La Salette is nowhere near as famous as Lourdes, and they hope to keep it that way. They make sure that not too much of La Salette always comes out, because it's a period of history which is not that happy. One of the first Marian apparitions, actually sometimes called the beginning of the Marian era, happened in the center of Paris in Rue de Bac, where a woman who was there saw various apparitions, including Vincent de Paul and what was later termed to be the Virgin Mary. Again, there, when you go there and you have been there with me, you see how the church absolutely controls this.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely makes sure that they are all over there. And you almost want to go out of there and take and kind of, go into a chemist and ask for anti-churchness and take a shower, because churchiality is dripping off you when you leave that place.
Well, it has become a very modern recruitment tool for the Catholic Church, and they use it as such. It's like, it should have a flashing neon sign that says, come join the church here, because that's really what they're using it for. It's unfortunately not a beautiful celebration of something, powerful and holy that happened there. It's a very sort of modern, I think, garish, flashing neon sign for recruitment. And we also had a similar experience in Rouen last year when we went in search of Joan of Arc's execution site. And that was, I'm still queasy when I think about that. It was really such a terrible experience. It's very rare that I talk about having a terrible experience in France. But going to Rouen in search of the Joan episode was nauseating for me. It was distressing. And on this site where Joan was executed, they have built this horrible modern church where Joan is not even represented. She's not even in the church. This horrible modern structure, which is this kind of 1970s gross Nouveau Vatican recruitment center. It's like, let's get people in here and join the church because of Joan. You know, and you stand there and you look around this ugly monstrosity where Joan isn't even represented. There isn't even an image of her anywhere in the church. And all I can think of is the church is the one who condemned her and burned her at the stake. You know, you would think that there would at least be some kind of beautiful, graceful acknowledgement of this extraordinary holy woman who is also the patron saint of France, rather than this, you know, sort of hideous industrial building that's there to get you to convert to Catholicism. Or if you already are a Catholic, it's very much about getting young people involved in the power of the young Catholic movement. There's a lot of information that's geared toward young people who clearly come there fascinated by Joan's story. And again, it's all about, you know, becoming modern Christian soldiers. And I just find the whole thing really distressing just because it feels very disrespectful to me. There is no respect for this woman who gave her life in this place. And let's remember, Joan gave her life because she did have visions. She was burned as a witch because she did claim to have visitations from the Archangel Michael and from St. Catherine and St. Margaret. And so, you know, this woman who is executed by the church for being a heretic because she is having a mystical experience is now being used in this really appalling way.
Well, and, you know, it is so often said that the church usurped the power of the divine feminine. And I think that is nowhere more apparent than in these Marian apparitions. I think, you know, they have taken something which really is the divine feminine manifesting itself into reality and have made it into something completely different. If they could get away with it, they would have made the little girl into a boy. They have made it, you know, so clearly about something else that I think billions of people need to wade through so many layers before they ever get to the true core of this. And the church is so clever in doing this by creating these fake secrets of Fatima, by pretending that these are all Catholic or Christian girls who really are so devout, and what else would they see than the Virgin Mary? And look, you know, there's 150 years of clear evidence that this is all to do with the Virgin Mary, and it's all a lie. And once again, with the Turin Shroud, there is something very real happening at the core. I always think that people who hate the church or are not on side with this, who are skeptical of their motives, but who are open-minded, who search for the larger whole, they always throw these things like the Turin Shroud and apparitions out like the baby with the bathwater, because it is so many layers before you get there that you realize that what is there is actually great, beautiful, direct evidence that our reality is so much more than we think it is. But because the church has put its signature and its hands all over, it has become so about something else that again, it takes an awful lot of hard work and stripping off layers before that core truth and beauty is revealed.
Certainly, we can start doing this in September because we are going to be in Bosnia, and then we can take a trip to Medjugorje and take a look there. And I think that might be an interesting segue for you to talk a little bit about what's happening in Bosnia in September.
Absolutely, because apart from taking people to Sacred France in the September, early September, we are taking people to the beautiful Bosnian capital and everything which Bosnia has to offer, the Bosnian pyramids specifically. The first half of this tour will be focused on the Bosnian pyramids, where my good self and Samos Manegic will be leading you through the tunnels up the pyramids, down the pyramids as well. You will be participating in a hidden history conference where I will be speaking, as well as other people like Michael Tellinger, Klaus Donner, and Sam Osmanagic himself. we will also be taking in so much of the beauty which is Sarajevo. Sarajevo is a lovely place. It's one of those, when the history of Europe is really written, then Sarajevo really stands to prominence there. We are taking people to places like Mostar, also to places such as Srebrenica, and as you were saying, also to places such as Medjugorje. All of that is happening at the beginning of September, and people can head over the next few days to my website and click on tours, and they will be taken there. But that is all in the future, and we will definitely be speaking more about Bosnia, because right now we have once again come to the end of our weekly Spirit Revolution. If you want to listen to this show again, you can do so in a number of ways. There is spiritrevolution.com, there is iTunes, there is BBS Radio Archive on bbsradio.com, and there is also Facebook. But until the next week, from the two of us,
the truth against the world.